From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. While you were making plans for the long weekend, voters across Europe were busy shaking up the European Parliament. Europeans voted in numbers not seen in 20 years and chipped away at the power of traditional centrist lawmakers. Voters in the UK also punished the Conservative and Labour parties for failing to deliver Brexit, the UK's departure from the EU. The BBC's Gavin Lee joins us now from Brussels. And Gavin, what's the broad theme that emerged in this election? Is this still even a pro-Europe parliament?
Yes, because two-thirds of the European Parliament are made up of parties that are pro-European. I think what we can take away is that it's far more diverse than it's ever been before, you know, since the 50s, since its inception after the Second World War. The traditional two parties were the centre-right and the socialists. The EPP and the socialists saw a big ebbing away of their support. They're still the biggest two parties, but they could previously do things by majority. We've seen three things happen here. One, the Liberal parties have had the biggest increase, 37 seats around all of the country. Biggest notable victories in Spain, where they've got a socialist prime minister, and also in the Netherlands as well, where they're expecting the far right to do. A flowering of the Green Party, particularly in Germany, where they were second to Angela Merkel's party. Actually, for under 30s, they were the most popular. And the young teenage Swede Greta Thunberg, you know, thanked for the effect, a ripple effect across Europe. And the other thought,
climate
a lot
change
of people,
activist, right?
Exactly. The school strike climate change activist, which has seen strikes in Germany, Belgium, the States as well, you know, children taking time off and making their impact. The Green Party have given a lot of credit to the movement that she struck up.
Well, Gavin, were the victories by the Greens and the Liberals on the left more surprising than the gains that the Nationalists saw in the Parliament?
Yes, I think I'll tell you why. The nationalist gains were expected to be big, but they were expected to be bigger. The nationalists and the far right, under what seemed to be the man of the moment, Matteo Salvini, the interior minister of Italy, the most powerful man in Italy at the moment, the head of the League Party, the anti-migrant, anti-Islamic, talks about returning the patriot sense of a nation to Italy. He's forming what he called a super coalition with far-right parties all over Europe joining him. Well, actually, there has been some victory, but some big losses as well. The far-right in France won. They beat Emmanuel Macron's party with Marine Le Pen leading that. They'll team up. But if you look at Spain, if you look at Holland, Denmark too, Portugal, for example, if you choose somebody who is the opposite of Donald Trump, you know, this is Antonio Costa, the socialist leader, who wears a cap saying, "We are part of Europe." And actually on the back, at one point, he used to say, "Make Europe great again." Hmm. He stormed to victory. You know, he's probably as European federalist as you can get. So a very mixed picture. And of course, you've got the Brexit effect of the Brexit Party in the UK being one of the biggest parties now for potentially a temporary period in the European Parliament.
So there was some concern before this election that the rise of these nationalist groups would be able to unravel the EU from the inside. It looks like you're saying maybe that's not the case and that they won't have as much power to deconstruct the organization as feared.
Well, as the dust is settling now, they seem to have collectively around 20 more seats than they did back in 2014. Now, a lot of those pro-EU voices, I spoke to one senior official at the European Council, the conduit for many of the big governments that, you know, makes these talks happen. Their view was that they will hold their nose and they will start to work out where the future for the EU is after that, which we're talking November, when the next session starts with a new Commission president. You know, before the EU referendum, you and I spoke about potential for Dexit, Frexit, Nexit, so Holland, you know, the Netherlands, Denmark, France. Well, there is none of those nationalist or far-right parties have campaigned for their countries to leave the EU. The Swedish Democrats were the party up until 2 months ago that were doing exactly that. They changed their tune.
I mentioned that turnout hasn't been this strong in the last 20 years. Why do you think people were so energized?
The EU, for good and bad, has become a word, a name that's been on the front pages because of the various crises. I mean, let's face it, you just step back a second. Europe has gone through a political rope-a-dope moment. They've been on the ropes for 4 years. You've had the Greek financial crisis, the migration crisis, terrorist attacks, multiple attacks all over Europe, and you've had Brexit. And as one EU official said to me today, it's brought people to the polling stations to have their say.
Now we'll see if anything can get done in the EU Parliament with this change in the makeup of these parties. The BBC's Gavin Lee speaking to us from Brussels. Thanks so much.
Speak to you soon.
And back here in this country, emaciated gray whales have been washing up on the west coast at a rate that's alarming scientists. At least 64 dead whales have now been found since the animals began their spring migration north to cooler waters off the coast of Alaska. John Kalambokides is a biologist and founder of Cascadia Research in Olympia, Washington. He joins us now. Hi, John.
Nice to talk to you.
Nice to speak with you. At least twice as many gray whales as usual have washed ashore in your state, dozens more in California, a few now in Alaska. What's happening?
Yes, and I think we're up to 20 in Washington state alone, and already that's the highest we've had on record since an event that occurred in 1999, 2000, and we may be on our way to exceeding those numbers from that previous event, because we're still early in the year, and typically we see peak gray whale strandings in April, May, June, and sometimes into July. So we're still early in this peak period, and it has not shown signs of abating yet.
I know you go out to some of these beaches to examine the whales once they wash up. What are you seeing? What state are they in?
Well, we get reports from all around the state. Some have been in inside waters, some in outside waters. There's typically a team that goes out, might be six, seven, eight people. Some of these, by the time they hit the beach, are in pretty decomposed condition, and not too much of an exam can be conducted, but we still try to respond. And if it's fresh enough, we'll actually conduct an internal exam. The most common finding that's come out of these is a lot of these animals are really malnourished, so emaciated. They'll have a visible blubber layer, but there'll be almost no oil at all, no fat left in that blubber layer.
So they're starving. Why would that be?
Yes, and part of the life cycle of gray whales is that they feed only for typically about 8 months out of the year. And then they fast for 4 months during their migration south to their breeding grounds in Mexico. Their time on the breeding grounds and their time migrating back, they're largely not feeding. So really what we're seeing now is the effect of how much food and reserve that they have from feeding last year, because we're right at the tail end of that four-month fast. And these are animals that didn't quite have enough of a reserve to make it through that period.
And where would they have been feeding? I mean, I guess I'm just trying to understand, like, where's the problem?
Gray whales are interesting. They show quite a bit of variability, but the bulk of the population goes and feeds in Arctic waters. And they're primarily feeding on these small bottom-dwelling amphipods that live in the bottom. And gray whales have this unique adaptation of being able to feed right on the bottom, sucking up a slurry of sediment and organisms. So we think, because that's where most of the gray whales go and the main prey they feed on, that's where the issue is. And we have two things occurring. We have an increasing recovering gray whale population, so there are more and more gray whales, and we think at least this eastern portion of the population is back up to pre-whaling numbers. And most scientists, including me, think that the main thing that limits populations is the food supply.
So they may just be competing for food, but it, could it be also related to the fact that they're feeding in these cold Arctic waters and there are signs that sea temperatures are rising and sea ice is melting? Could that be part of the problem?
It's definitely part of the reason for our concern, because the increased number of gray whales is part of the story, but it's clearly not the only part of the story, because we've seen this huge spike in mortality. So it looks like an interaction between more gray whales and a downturn in the abundance of their prey. And because they're right at the limit of the food supply, any downturn has these much bigger consequences. Now, the question we don't know the answer to what degree is any of those changes related to the huge changes that are occurring in the Arctic ecosystem, the dramatic decrease in ice cover. Part of what limits gray whales to where they can feed is, you know, what areas are covered with ice, and it probably also interacts with how their prey grow. And we don't know the answer to that, but that's obviously one of the most important questions we'll be trying to answer.
In the San Francisco Bay Area recently, at least three whales have been struck by ships and they have died. So they did not die of starvation or malnutrition, but is there any link there to what's going on?
Yes, because along when these gray whales are in poor condition, what we do see is we see more and more of them showing up in unusual areas trying to feed. So these are whales that might normally be migrating up to the Arctic, but because they're running out of their reserves, are in a more desperate search for prey and showing up in unusual areas. So not just in San Francisco Bay, we see the same phenomenon in Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. It also occurred in around the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach. There were almost a dozen gray whales that wandered into those waters, and often those whales coming into those waters are facing additional overlap with human activities, whether that be shipping activities or in some cases it's been fishing activities and, you know, crab gear and nets. So it does make them more vulnerable to other things. But we do think at the core of it is this prey issue and their body condition.
Not an easy time for gray whales on the Pacific Ocean. John Kalambokides is a biologist at the nonprofit Cascadia Research in Washington State. Thanks for your time. We appreciate it. Maine's governor signed a bill on Friday that ended most non-medical exemptions for mandatory childhood vaccines. It's now one of four states that require vaccines regardless of religious or philosophical beliefs. Recent measles outbreaks are blamed on anti-vaccine activists, people who choose not to vaccinate their children on various grounds, even though science shows that vaccines are safe and effective. But what many don't know is that vaccine hesitancy and resistance has been with us since the early experiments that led to the development of immunizations. Ben Brock Johnson and Amory Sievertson, producers of the podcast Endless Thread, have the story.
It's the year 1721 in Boston, and things are not great. A smallpox outbreak arrives from the Caribbean via passengers on a ship called the HMS Seahorse. Over half the entire city is hit with the virus. People are dying left and right.
If you've never seen smallpox, it kind of looks like your skin has been turned into bubble wrap. Ugh. You have thousands and thousands of these painful-looking pustules. It sounds like a nightmare.
I think it was a nightmare, and you don't have to take our word for it.
When smallpox broke out, there was widespread panic.
Gareth Williams is a professor emeritus of medicine at the University of Bristol in the UK, and he wrote the book The Angel of Death, The Story of Smallpox.
And 90% of its victims were kids under the age of five, so it had a great reputation as being the slayer of innocence. And if you got it and you lived, you weren't necessarily that lucky, because about a third of the survivors were badly scarred, and they could be hideously disfigured. There are plenty of cases on record of people who survived smallpox and then killed themselves because they couldn't bear to look in the mirror.
When it came around, and it did every few years, sometimes through trade routes, smallpox could infect 60% of a population, and a third of those people might straight up die. So Cotton Mather is a minister in a predominantly Puritan Boston, and in his world, this is just like a regularly occurring horrible thing that happens every few years. And in his particular group of Christians, everyone believes it's just God's will.
There used to be a time when we got infectious diseases and there was nothing we could do other than just kind of live through them or die.
Rene Nahara is an epidemiologist and the editor of The History of Vaccines, a website studying the global history of vaccination. He knows a ton about the story of terrible diseases and how humanity has figured out ways to fight them.
Rene knows that whatever time period you are talking about, how humanity usually fights disease is with a mix of folklore, faith, and hopefully a good bit of scientific knowledge. Cotton Mather is no exception.
And maybe more importantly, Mather is spending a lot of time around an enslaved person who knows something that he doesn't.
He owned a slave from Africa whose name I always slaughter to. It's Onesimus. O-N-E-S-I-M-U-S.
This wasn't his real name, by the way. It's just a biblical name that Mather called him. It means useful.
And the slave had a mark on his arm. And Mr. Mather said, you know, what is that mark? And Onesimus said, they gave us a smallpox so we wouldn't get the smallpox. And that was very interesting to him. He's like, what are you talking about?
Mather says, I gotta look into this. So he sends out letters all over the world to all of his fellow scholars of European descent, of course. He's like, is this a thing? And they say,
Yep.
The letters come back and people in Turkey say, oh yeah, I've heard about this. The Arabs do it all the time. They take a lancet and they lance the pus out of somebody with smallpox and they insert that lancet into somebody's arm or somebody's hand. And then those people, if they get a fever, they do get a little bit sick. But if they don't, if they don't die from full-blown smallpox, they become immune.
It's a pretty wild idea. And, as it turns out, an ancient one, discovered and practiced in a lot of different cultures. Taking smallpox scabs or pus and introducing the virus to the body to protect people from getting the full-blown disease.
So how did this practice start? Here's how René Naharal thinks it might have gone down. In 10th century China, in the Gobi Desert.
My personal guess is that somebody died of smallpox. Somebody came upon their body, and the body was desiccated, and they breathed in the dust from the body. And then that person went into some place where there was massive amounts of smallpox. They didn't get sick. And they themselves said, I wonder if it was because I was somehow protected by the spirit, the dust, the whatever came off of that body who had smallpox.
So it makes sense that this person in the Gobi Desert, who maybe inhaled some dead guy pixie dust and lived to tell the tale through a smallpox outbreak, might lead other people to say, we got to get us some dead guy pixie dust.
Which led to the ancient Chinese practice of drying out smallpox scabs, grinding them up, and blowing them up each other's noses with straws.
Much like cocaine, I guess, without the euphoria.
This is one form of something called inoculation by variolation. It's an early way to make people immune to disease. Now, fast forward several centuries.
And we're back at Cotton Mather's house in Boston. And he's reading these letters that have come in from all over the world, full of wild stories.
There was a lady in England called Lady Mary Wortley Montagu who had seen this practice being performed in Constantinople. Her husband was the ambassador to Turkey, to the Ottoman Empire. And she saw this being done to members of the diplomatic corps. They had sort of smallpox variolation parties with a little old Turkish lady turning up with half a walnut shell containing smallpox pus, and she would dip a needle into that and scratch it into the arms of the kids. And Lady Mary was so smitten with this that she actually got her own son variolated.
So Mather takes all of this information, and he's like, all right, let's do this. Let's start getting rid of smallpox in Boston with variolation, the predecessor to vaccination. Mather finds one physician, Zabdiel Boylston, who's willing to try this risky experiment.
Not a lot of volunteers come in right out of the gate. So they do it to enslaved people who haven't already been variolated back in Africa, and also their own children, some of whom are toddlers. Problematic for sure. Pretty soon, though, an even bigger problem pops up for Boylston and Mather's operation. The people they are enslaving and their own kids don't have a choice. But the other Puritans in Mather's community, even in his own congregation, are like, wait a minute, your slave told you about this?
Also, this smallpox outbreak is God's will. You know that. And you want to do what with old scabs and smallpox pustules?
Religious authorities got in on it as well for the same reasons of maintaining body purity, that the body was pure the way it was designed, and why should we mess with something that's natural?
So, take blatant racism, add in some squeamishness around scabs, stir in some puritanical beliefs. What do you get? You get the Society of Physicians Anti-Inoculators, led by the only person in the city of Boston who's technically an MD at the time.
11,000 people, only one real doctor.
William Douglas was the doctor's name, and Douglas starts this group. They meet in coffee shops around the city. They become very vocal.
Eventually, someone throws a bomb into Mather's house, which lands in a room where his nephew is recovering from variolation. The firebomb thrown into Mather's house malfunctioned. It never exploded. And despite the best efforts of the Society of Physicians Anti-Inoculators, Mather and Boylston's experiment becomes the first ever numbers-supported clinical trial in Western medical history, which is standard procedure now.
They're tallying up the people they save, the people they unintentionally kill, and the other people in the city who get smallpox and live or die. And then finally, Mather decides to send all of this information to the big boss.
He sends it off to the Queen of England saying, here's our report from your colonies, Your Majesty. This is what we did. And look, like, not a lot of people got smallpox, actually, you know, who were inoculated, variolated. And the British government then says, all right, everybody, all the colonies, now everybody's going to get this variolation.
A mandatory policy from the crown to the colonies. This doesn't go over great in pre-Revolutionary War Boston. I don't know why. I mean,
who'd have thunk it? And while Renee says there are other examples of resistance to variolation, this is kind of a crucial plot point in the story of vaccination. Because in some ways, you see the roots of two familiar ideas.
Well, number one, the government is not going to tell me what to do with my own body. And number two, you know, discrediting the science and saying, there's no evidence for this. You know, he got the idea from a slave. What do they know? He got the idea from the Arabs in Turkey. What do they know?
Skepticism of authority, xenophobia, racism, all still big issues in America 300 years later. And two ideas, freedom to choose, questions about the validity of the science of vaccines, both of these are still present and powerful in today's debates about vaccination.
Ben Brock Johnson and Amory Sievertson are co-hosts of the podcast Endless Thread. This story is part of a series they're doing on vaccines called Infectious. This is Here and Now.
It's 1965. A white minister is murdered in Selma, Alabama, but no one is held to account.
More than 50 years later, we return to the place where it happened to call a lie, and finally solve this murder.
White Lies from NPR. New episodes drop Tuesdays.
President Trump wraps up a four-day trip to Japan tomorrow. He and Prime Minister Shinzo Abe held a joint news conference today where the president said he's not bothered by recent short-range missile tests conducted by North Korea. NPR's Anthony Kuhn joins us now from Tokyo. And Anthony, how did Abe respond to what President Trump said about North Korea?
Well, Abe was not about to publicly clash with his guest. He praised Trump for breaking the diplomatic ice and engaging with North Korea. And also, he talked about the issue which is foremost for Japan, and that is Japanese citizens who were abducted by North Korea in the 1970s. And Trump spoke with the family members of these abductees, so he praised him for that. So when Trump says that he basically only cares about missiles that can hit the U.S., that actually does not go over well in either South Korea or Japan, which short and intermediate range missiles can hit. Of course, many Koreans and South Koreans and Japanese know, though, that Trump is trying to give diplomacy a chance to work, so they hold their tongues politely.
The issue of Iran came up today when Abe offered to broker negotiations between the U.S. and Tehran. Is that a realistic option?
On North Korea, Abe is the only regional leader who's not met with Kim Jong-un of North Korea. But it's a different case with Iran because Japan and Iran actually do have fairly close relations. The Iranian foreign minister came just ahead of Trump's visit, and Abe may actually travel to Iran next month. And so Abe said that he was willing to do whatever he could to try to broker a deal.
Some division over the issue of trade as well between Japan and the United States. President Trump said there is a huge trade imbalance with Japan. And before this meeting, the threat of tariffs on the auto industry was hanging over the meeting. Did that issue come up?
It certainly did. The U.S. has given Japan 6 months to reach a deal on car exports, or it will impose tariffs. And that would be a disaster for Japan's economy. The two sides are also at odds over agricultural products. The U.S. wants Japan to open its markets to things like U.S. beef and pork. And it previously reached a deal to do so called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, but Trump pulled out of that. So now the U.S. has to try to get back what it already had but threw away. And Trump insisted at the presser today that it was a bad deal. But he also said that there probably will be no deal before August. That's because the U.S. has its hands full with another trade war with China. And also because Japan has elections and any big concessions to the U.S. could influence the vote against Abe.
Anthony, aside from the issues that these two men discussed, there was a lot of pageantry to this meeting, a trip to a sumo wrestling championship. There was a visit with the new emperor. How would you say the relationship between Japan and the United States comes out after this summit?
What's interesting about Shinzo Abe's relationship with Donald Trump is that it means everything to him, but in a contradictory way. I mentioned about the elections. And this election is crucial for Abe because his ultimate goal is to change the U.S.-drafted post-war constitution and restore the country to its former prestige as the premier power in Asia, as it was before World War II. And in order to do this, he has to keep political and economic cooperation with the U.S. very close. But ultimately, his goal is to make the country more independent from the U.S.
NPR international correspondent Anthony Kuhn speaking with us from Tokyo. Anthony, thanks.
My pleasure.
And this next story sounds like it could be a country song. Three outsiders try to unseat the champions of a world-famous rodeo and win. Well, it also happens to be true. In Cheyenne, Wyoming, 1908, three cowboys from Hawaii arrive at the Frontier Days Rodeo, which was one of the biggest spectacles the U.S. had to offer at the time. What most of the spectators didn't know was that these Hawaiians came from a ranching tradition that was decades older than anything in Texas, Wyoming, or Colorado. Authors David Wolman and Julian Smith tell this story in their new book, Aloha Rodeo. David, Julian, welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So maybe the most interesting thing that we learn in this book is how cattle first come to the Hawaiian Islands and become an invasive species. David, why don't you pick it up? Start there. How did those cows get on the island?
Sure. Well, this was at the very end of the 18th century. Captain George Vancouver is sailing to the islands, and part of the British Empire's strategy worldwide was to bring gifts to these faraway lands that they were visiting, but also what they really perceived as kind of useful gifts. And one of the gifts was some longhorn cattle. The king puts a taboo on killing any of the cattle. And so they reproduce wildly and very quickly. And within a matter of like two decades, there are thousands and thousands of feral cattle running all over the island of Hawaii.
And so they become almost a little too useful and so numerous that they need to be controlled. So that is going to lead to the rise of these Hawaiian cowboys, or as you described them, paniolos. What was their job like?
Their job was basically to find the cattle, first of all, in the jungles where they were hiding out. And they would rope these cows and bulls and take them down the mountainside, often across these barren, dry lava fields down onto the beach. And then they had to get them onto the boats that were waiting offshore because there weren't really any big docks where the boats could pull up.
These cowboys drove the cows into the surf, right?
Yep, they did. They used specially trained horses. They drove the cows straight into the ocean. They weren't always so cooperative. And of course, it being Hawaii in the middle of the Pacific, every so often, a shark would cruise by and say, there's lunch, and take out a cow or two.
You did not see that in Wyoming at the time, I'm sure of that. But you did focus on one of these cowboys in particular. His name was Ikua Purdy, and he was legendary. He was like the best around. What can you tell us about him?
Ikua Purdy is a third generation cowboy in the islands. And so, you know, before he's a teenager, I mean, this guy, he's riding horses all of the time. Ranching and cattle is just part of life there. And Ikua very quickly demonstrates a kind of virtuosity when it comes to riding and roping. That sort of leads to this idea after the turn of the 20th century that maybe this guy should be sent off to Wyoming to compete with some of the cowboys on the mainland.
Okay, so let's put the pause button on Ikua Purdy for a second. We're going to get back to him and what he does in Wyoming eventually, but let's talk about Cheyenne, Wyoming, which in its own right had become something of a cattle mecca, and at one point, you write, it was one of the wealthiest cities of its size in the world.
Yeah, the story of Cheyenne is really incredible. It started out as, you know, one of the many dusty outposts along the Transcontinental Railroad. But when the great age of the cattle drive started in the 1860s, 1870s, they had all these cattle down in Texas, but they needed to fatten them up. And what Cheyenne had at that time was it was close to these huge grasslands, and they were open for the taking. And it was also connected by rail with markets back east. So it kind of had this 1-2 combination. And it had the amazing cowboys who lived there. So that combination led to this incredible stratospheric boom time in Cheyenne history. And then when the age of the cattle drives started to end, when the Wild West was being fenced off by homesteaders and barbed wire, its crash was just as fast.
Mm. And because of that, the city needed something. It was kind of desperate to get its name back on the map. And that's where the Frontier Days comes in, right?
Right. The city fathers, they saw how quickly Cheyenne had risen and crashed. And they looked around and they said, we need something else or else this town may dry up and vanish. So they looked at other cities that had had these rodeos that were just starting to spread. Denver had some festivals, other cities in Wyoming. There's a great quote where one of the city fathers said, we don't raise anything in Cheyenne except hell, because all these other cities had these agricultural festivals.
Yeah, there's like the potato day and the pickle day.
And they really wanted to take advantage of that hard edge.
Right. It was a really interesting time in American history. It was kind of the twilight of the Wild West, and they were conscious of that. They saw this incredible time in American history that they were so proud of and still are, but they saw it starting to fade. And so they consciously decided to preserve this heritage. And one of the ways of doing that was through rodeos. It was as much a celebration of Western culture and history as it was a demonstration of the incredible talent of these cowboys.
Well, and speaking of a PR move, somebody there had this idea that they should get the Hawaiians to come to Wyoming to make this absolutely monumental journey from the Hawaiian Islands to the Mountain West. Tell us how that happened and how they decided that Ikua Purdy should come and rope steer.
What happened is the year before the 1908 Cheyenne Frontier Days, in 1907, a Hawaiian cowboy named Eben Lowe traveled to the States and to the mainland and went to watch Cheyenne Frontier Days. And Eben is sitting in the stands watching the local talent compete. And he's thinking, essentially, my cousins could beat these guys. So Eben makes this suggestion, and he actually first invites some of the guys from Wyoming to come to Honolulu in December of 1907. And there's a great moment there because one guy goes down to compete. He leaves a blizzard in Wyoming in December, gets to Honolulu. By the way, he's looking around at rainbows. And
he's like, I'm never leaving this place.
And he never left. And he never left. So anyway, so that was how we see the seed being planted for the cowboys to go from the islands to Cheyenne in 1908.
When the Hawaiians get to Cheyenne, how are they received? Because they must have seemed like such outsiders and even foreigners.
Right. At that point, a lot of people weren't even aware that the Hawaiian Islands had been annexed by the United States roughly 10 years before. So these guys show up. They look obviously very different. Their equipment is somewhat similar, but also a little different than the local cowboys. They had leis around their cowboy hats. And so they show up in Cheyenne where, you know, in Wyoming at the time, the attitude was there's no better cowboys than Wyoming cowboys. They had won every competition almost in Frontier Days over the past 10 years that had been held. So when these guys show up, it's a mix of curiosity and patronizing almost a little bit. They said, oh, yeah, we're glad that they came, but there's no way they can win.
And it wasn't true. The Wyomingites were not the best cowboys. These guys from Hawaii won.
There's this wonderful evolution in the newspaper record covering Frontier Days competition during that summer, because at first the news of the Hawaiians coming to town, you know, that was something to be celebrated and further affirmation that Frontier Days was the preeminent rodeo in the world. Then on day one, after the Hawaiians demonstrate their prowess, you see this shift in the sort of sports writing coverage that is like, okay, well, it's great that we welcomed them here, but now Wyoming guys, like, let's send them packing.
Right.
And, you know, we need to remind them sort of who's best, who's boss. And, of course, that's not how it transpired.
On the third day, the day of the championship, they take the prize. They take the trophy home, essentially. And then they go back to Hawaii. They're heroes at home. What did Ikua Purdy's victory mean for Hawaiians and the identity of people on the islands, which, as you say, not long before had been annexed by the United States?
Hawaii was going through an identity crisis at the time. Basically, they had been absorbed into this huge, far-flung empire, and they were wondering how they fit into the political sphere of the world. And there's a great quote in one of the papers after these guys get back home, which, by the way, they were received with these huge parties. Every time they stepped off the boat, there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people singing. They composed songs in their honor. They composed hula in their honor. Mm. There's a great quote from one of the papers that says, "We've shown the United States Hawaii is more than a hula platform in the far Pacific." And that kind of sums up what it meant for these people culturally. They had crossed an ocean and they had beaten the Americans at their own game, even though they were now part of the United States.
Well, it's a great book, Aloha Rodeo, Julian Smith and David Wolman. Thanks very much for writing it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Americans are weighed down by more than $1 trillion in credit card debt, according to the Federal Reserve, and the interest rates on credit cards are at a record high. That's the backdrop for a pair of bills introduced earlier this month by Senator Bernie Sanders and Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that would cap all credit card interest rates at 15%. In this divided Congress, the bill isn't likely to go anywhere, but Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez are offering a blueprint on this issue for progressives in the Democratic Party. Renee Merle covers Wall Street for The Washington Post. Hi, Renee.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Anyone who's been following the careers of these two politicians is probably not surprised to see them sponsoring a bill like this, but what is it that they're trying to accomplish with it?
Basically, what the bill would do is cap interest rates on credit cards at 15%. So they would basically be trying to cap those rates and take money out of the pockets of the banks.
And how high have credit card rates gotten recently compared to historical averages?
Well, the median right now is about 21%, but it's higher if you have a lower credit score. And it's rising faster also if you have a lower credit score.
Lenders do not like this. Not surprisingly, they say it could have unintended consequences and that it unfairly lumps together credit cards with other kinds of consumer loans and payday loans. Even just the name of this bill, the Loan Shark Prevention Act, does paint lenders as a loan shark. How's the industry pushing back?
Well, the industry is calling this 15% cap arbitrary, and they're concerned that this is going to become part of the, you know, general discourse, particularly going into the 2020 election. They think that any efforts to restrict how they charge consumers could have a big impact on their bottom lines.
And wouldn't this bill limit the available supply of credit for consumers if banks just aren't willing to lend money at less than 15%?
Well, that is the argument from the industry, and that might be true. It's particularly for, like, if you think about payday lenders who are now charging interest rates upwards of 300%, you know, obviously you're going to see them, most of that industry, potentially go out of business if they're really capped at 15%. A lot of them are going to walk away. But a decade ago, credit card interest rates were around 12%. So it's not that the industry has never operated at a time where interest rates were lower than 15%. It's not a figure that's outrageous. It's just that in some way they don't like the idea of the government restricting the way that they do business in this area at all.
Well, they would make a lot less money too.
They would make a lot less money, but they think it sets a dangerous precedent that the government would be able to set the rates that they charge consumers. They want to be able to respond to economic trends, respond to the track record of the consumer. Maybe this consumer is constantly behind on their bills and has defaulted in the past, and they want to charge them more to accommodate for taking the risk and even offering them credit. So the industry just thinks that, you know, any restrictions will harm them and their ability to offer credit cards in a way that protects them, not just bolsters their bottom line, but protects them from the downside risk to lending to certain people.
Well, going back to the 1980s, Congress capped credit union interest rates at 15%, so that it's already happened before. But what's happened since then on that legislation?
They capped interest rates at 15% for credit unions, but then, like in 1987, they raised it to 18%, and it stayed above that level, or stayed at 18% ever since. So for credit unions, at least, they've decided that 15% is just too low.
Okay, it's not just credit cards, because this bill would also allow the U.S. Postal Service to get into the banking industry. Why is that part of the deal?
This is actually an issue that probably bothers banks even more than the idea of capping interest rates. They don't want the Postal Service to become a competitor. There are a lot of Democrats and consumer advocates like the idea of the Postal Service being able to offer a savings account, a checking account, just basic banking services, assuming that this will open banking services to the poor and in neighborhoods where a lot of banks are like pulling or closing down their branches. The banking industry absolutely abhors this idea and thinks that it'll, you know, it creates unfair competition, and they just don't like the idea.
I'm listening to you talk, and I'm wondering if Bernie Sanders is taking a swipe at Joe Biden with this legislation. Both men are at the top of the polls for the 2020 Democratic nomination. And Biden, of course, has been heavily criticized for his cozy relationship with banks over the years. Is there anything to that?
I'm not sure if it was a direct hit exactly, but I don't think there's any way not to look at this legislation, think about it in terms of 2020. Not only is Bernie Sanders running for president, but these issues become part of the debate and could become, you know, come up on the presidential debate stage. And the industry people and the lobbyists I talk to say if Democrats do take the Senate in 2020, then it becomes a part of the discourse then too. So, in a way, by introducing this legislation and giving it a national platform, Bernie Sanders is helping set an agenda that will go throughout the presidential election and perhaps the next Congress.
That's Renee Merle, reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd. Thanks for spending a part of your holiday weekend with us. It's Here and Now.